We're going to be discussing in the context of moral government today some wonderful truths. I was converted 6.5 years ago after having grown up in an evangelical church and went to Bible school and graduated and was ordained, and I pastored for a couple years. Then I did evangelistic work for 4 years. I preached that if any man is in Christ, he is a new creature. I preached, behold, all things passed away. Behold, old things passed away. Behold, all things become new. I preached them. I did have a strong emphasis upon that the Church of Christ ought to have revival and ought to be living a holy life. I preached that as I understood it at the time. But that's as far as I could go with it, that ought to. And that's what the law, of course, requires of us. They didn't have any further understanding. My life fell apart. It was already falling apart, but it couldn't sustain the pressures of a marriage relationship. My life could not stand the pressures of the ministry because I had no substance in my faith and no substance in my heart and my life. So I couldn't sustain the strength that it took to keep a relationship going and all of that. So my ministry ended, the ministry ended, my marriage ended at the same time for the same reasons. God was gracious to let me get into a type of work that I had no training for and was able to make a living at. For 10 years I was in the business world selling real estate, thinking that my life was wonderful because I was a Christian, and finally someday after this life I would finally be with the Lord, and that would make what I was going through in this world all worthwhile. Didn't realize that the reason that this world needed to be made worthwhile is because I didn't have anything in this world that was worthwhile. Living for Christ, living for God, the way I was living, wasn't worthwhile. So I had to wait to get to heaven to make it worthwhile, at least in my view. God's grace, constant forbearance with all sinners, continued to move against me, continued to confront me in different ways. Directed my attention to realize that I never understood anything that was in Romans 6, 7, and 8. I had no clue what was in there. It was a veil over the face of it, and I had no comprehension what was in those chapters at all. And I realized it and recognized it. So I began, I worked hard for a year and paid off all my debts except my mortgage. I lived a very meager lifestyle in order to support myself by just working handyman jobs. I gave myself to start reading. Start looking into Romans 6, 7, and 8. Started reading a series on Romans 6, 7, and 8 by somebody that all of you would know. He suggested something when I got to Romans 7 I had never heard in my life. I had never heard in my life, but he proved it to my mind that it was true, and it turned all my theology upside down, and I had not yet heard of moral government. I read another man's writings that everyone would know, and he said the same thing, and I had never heard that in my life. I had never heard that in my life. Then I found out that there were some sermons by Charles Finney that were in publication that had never been published before, a whole series called the Principle Series and the Promise of the Spirit. Somebody told me that they were in print. I had Charles Finney's Systematic Theology when I was in Bible school. I bought a copy of it, tried to read it, couldn't understand it. I could understand that it was powerful. I could understand that it was absolutes. I could understand it was either or, but I couldn't understand it. So I'd keep it on my shelf. I'd pull it off once in a while. Charles Finney was an admired person in my mind. I admired the fact that anybody could reap the fruit and harvest that of those numbers of that quality that I read about in his revivals, and historians would verify. I admire anybody who would have a ministry that brings people to Christ and would be involved in revival. But I didn't understand what he was talking about. In the context of my studies for Romans 6 and 7 and 8, I got the series on the Promise of the Spirit and Principle Series, and began to read that, and I found Charles Finney also said that same thing as these other people said regarding Romans 7 that I had come to believe already. And as I continued to read, God began to break my heart down and to realize that I was lost. I came to realize about 1986 that I was lost. Could not piece together exactly what I may or may not have had before. It didn't sustain me. My faith did not cause anything to be sustained. But I knew at that point in time, in 1986, I was lost. I was in bondage to sin. I was in bondage to lust. I was in bondage to the flesh. I was lost. And for 3 months, I sat in a state of despair. I was convicted for longer than that. But the conviction rose to a point where I despaired of my life ever changing, because I knew from within me came nothing but bondage to my flesh, to my desires. According to Ephesians chapter 2, I lived according to the desires of my flesh and of my mind, and that was me. And I knew I wasn't a Christian. I knew I wasn't born again. I knew I did not love God. I knew I did not have life. And I didn't know there was any way out. I had not yet understood the gospel. I understood the words grace and mercy from a different context, which had no meaning in them. But I didn't understand the true gospel and true grace and true mercy. God graciously continued to use the sermons of Charles Finney as his means to cause me to understand what the gospel offers to one who's in bondage to sin, and how and what to believe. I saw it laid before me, and finally God developed it sufficiently before me that I could understand how God leads one out of bondage. And I put my confidence and faith in that gospel that he showed me. And my heart was set free for the first time in my life. The love of God was shed abroad in my heart for the first time in my life. I had peace with God for the first time in my life. Old things passed away for the first time in my life. All things became new. I opened up Romans 6 and I read it. And I was reading in my biography. It was as clear as a bell. Because Romans 6 is not directions of how to get saved, how to overcome. Romans 6 is a description of one who has victory in Christ Jesus. So things just, they were just open. They were open because I was new. My mind was renewed. My heart was new. Everything was radically different. I began to share with other people, mostly just crying, because I really couldn't put it into words what was in my heart, my mind. It was so large in here and words are so small. How can you do it? It's like trying to put a watermelon in a hypodermic needle and cause it to be a watermelon in the person that you put it in. It just couldn't convey it. It wasn't really sometime till after that that I recognized, or it dawned on me, that the view that was taught to my heart through these various people that I read and the scriptures that I was reading, the view had a name to it. It was called moral government. I had no idea that had a name to it. All I knew was that the truth that I was reading and understanding and was believing, and this truth opened my eyes to my own state. And then as I continued to read, this truth opened my eyes and understanding to the gospel. And when I believed it, it produced the change that the scriptures describe. And I didn't know that it had a name on it, moral government. But later I did, as I continued to read and share my testimony, and then people began to say, oh, you're this and you're that. So I suffered the consequences of believing the gospel. In India right now, in the paper that I read just this last week, there's a terrible crisis, particularly in the big cities. The traffic flow has crawled to about a half the speed that it was before. The reason is because all the cows that they think are sacred and used to wander the fields and stuff, there's so much rain and mud that the cows can't survive and can't move in the mud, so now they're walking the streets of the cities. Just like a big city like Philadelphia. And people, if they honk their horns, the cows ignore it. These are called sacred cows, because the Hindus believe that it might be their ancestor inside that cow. So it's not permitted to kill them. In fact, if you nudge them with the bumper of your car, you can get fined, ticketed and fined. Because they're sacred. And sacred cows have a way of being that way. When we call them sacred, then we even make it illegal to do anything to move them. I had a lot of sacred cows in my thinking. Nobody dared touch them, including myself, because they are what I took comfort in and support in and held on to. And they were my sacred cows. You might have sacred cows yourself this morning. And I pray that you would be willing to perhaps let them drop to a lower degree and let them be nudged out of the way, and let the traffic of truth flow to your heart. I know that there are people here today that could probably teach this better or differently, from a different perspective, approaching it differently. It is a marvelously broad and beautiful view of the truth. It is just the truth as I see it. And I'll be sharing that with you this morning. There are other people here that I trust that you will get to know, because they might provide relationships for you the rest of your life that would be very valuable. both in encouraging you in your faith, and you can encourage them in their faith. And it might be a people that could stimulate your thinking further along these lines that might have seen things that you have not yet seen, and vice versa. And that you could be of mutual benefit to one another. So, and I trust that you'll take time to do that between the breaks throughout the day. If you need any directions and things, ask Ron. The systematic theology of Charles Finney in 1878 was greatly abridged by Harry Kahn for his own reasons, which I respect. In 1976, Bethany House Publishers decided this year to publish the 1878 edition again, which is a larger edition with fuller teachings in it. And this is the reprint of it, and I had the privilege of working on that. This is an abridgment of the 1851 edition, which is about twice this size. Okay, and the 1851 edition is available not in print in stores. I have a copy, and I could make copies for those who would be willing to actually have it. But this is marvelous, and I recommend that you get this. I brought 8 copies today. There's no royalties involved or anything. We're able to get 8 on the plane, the weight and all that. And you can have one for $12. There are 15 in the store. We just brought some that you could hurry up and get them. But we're not here to sell books. I'd prefer that you all went to your bookstores and ordered them so they would stock them. But you're welcome to pick one up here today. Please pray for me. I need God's help in conveying the spirit of this matter and not the doctrine of it. I'm not here to dispute doctrine. I'm not here to be combative. I'm not here to put down any other person in history who had different ideas of theology or of God. I'm here to hold up what I have found in my mind is found to be the truth that converted me and brought me out of darkness. I pray that I will be able to convey it in such a way that is somewhat coherent to you. I believe that some things that I will show you would be absolutely undeniable. Moral law, moral government is practiced by every human being in this world, but most of the times they don't know it. If we lived in an age where there were no mirrors, people would say, "Well, look at that hair on your head. Have you ever seen the hair on your head?" And they would have to say, "No." There was a time when people never saw the hair on their head, until they looked in a pool, they could shine up some bronze and brass or something like that. But they knew it was there if they put their hand on it at times. But most of the time, even us don't think about the hair in our head. That is true with moral government. Every human being acts under the principles of moral government. We relate to each other under the principles of moral government. We live under human governments, which are instruments and part of God's moral government. The family is the lowest unit, the smallest unit, not the lowest importance, the most important, but the smallest unit of moral government in this world. Your family structure is a moral government structure, and its moral government operations gives marriage relationships the most harmonious, blessed, beautiful relationships when they are lived according to the principles of moral government. When those principles are broken, marriages are ruined, even if they don't separate. Is not in them what marriage is intended to have in them. Are we on, Ron? Thank you. So everyone is surrounded and involved in moral government. It's just that people don't know how that name could be applied to it. They understand the principles, that we live by the principles. We're just not conscious that we could put a label on them. For example, there's a plane crash recently in Seoul, South Korea. And they found out that the pilot and co-pilot were arguing over how to land the plane. Remember that story? The pilot was bringing the plane down. The co-pilot thought they were too far onto the runway to actually set down and come to a stop before they ran out of runway space. So he argued with and wrestled with the controls. Here's the pilot trying to land the plane. The co-pilot grabs the controls. They're both, you know why they crashed? They broke the rules of moral government. We'll show that to you. Tragedy of our times, in my view, is the publication of the sins of the leadership in the Christian church. I shouldn't say the publication. It's the sins of the leadership of the present church. Beginning in 1987, Jim Baker, Jimmy Swaggart, continuing on to David Hawking. I don't bring those names up to bring them down. We're talking about facts and matters of fact. Those situations have produced a necessary discussion of the character of the church. People have tried to clean up the finances of the church. We've written a lot about the character of leadership, what to do with fallen leaders. But why? What's the big deal? What's the big deal if a leader falls and admits to sexual sin, adultery, fornication? What's the big deal? Aren't we supposed to, in this world, don't we recognize that we all sin every day in thought, word, and deed? If that is true, if we all sin every day, if the grace of God is not sufficient to overcome sin in this world, then what's the big deal if a leader falls and sins and is known? We should praise God for the demonstration that this person, although he is this moment sinned, is under the grace of God and will yet go to heaven. Because the grace of God can't stop things like that. There should be a demonstration of the grace of God. But yet the church is humbled and ashamed, and rightly so, because everyone recognizes that ought not to be. And that's a confirmation of moral government. When there's a recognition that that ought not to be, is an affirmation in the mind of the principles of moral government. So when when a leader falls like that, why should we be concerned unless we know that it should be otherwise and can be otherwise? These are the issues that rise up and have to be discussed and will be discussed when we're discussing the gospel, and we'll discuss them here today. We're going to start at the beginning point, and I recognize that some would approach it differently, as I say, but I'm going to approach it, and I trust that as we go along, I know that your mind is going to be so stimulated with questions and tangential thoughts. Well, if that's so, then what about this and stuff? And you would be prone and interested to ask the question, well, if that's so, then what about this? And I understand that. I recognize that that's what's going to happen. But for the sake of time and keeping myself on track, ask those questions tonight at 6 o'clock at the question and answer period. But for now, please narrow your questions to a clarification. Is this what you mean by this? Please repeat that again. Can you say it another way? Because I'm not quite seeing that. Those kinds of questions. But please help me. Let us not go tangential, because we could go 100 different directions for the next 100 days and not finish. And I'm sure you all recognize that. The first session today is God's moral law, God's will for everyone. Unfortunately, it is not believed, by and large, it is not believed that the moral law is God's will for everyone. It is believed by many that God's will is for the sinner only until he sees his sin. And then it is no longer for the sinner once he believes the gospel. But that is really not for anyone. Because if it is for the sinner to show him his sins, then it is not required that he obey it, is it? It's just to show him his sin. So he hasn't obeyed it until he sees his sin. And then the belief is, once he believes the gospel, he's not required to follow God's law. Therefore, the sinner has never obeyed it, and the Christian need not obey it, so it is not required for anybody to really obey it and keep it, to have it fulfilled in their life. And I know you'll be tempted somewhere along the way to say Dennis is teaching legalism and stuff, but you'll find out that that is not true. Moral law. What do I mean by moral law? Question to you. What is moral law in your understanding? Let's start even more simply. What is law? What is law? Somebody define law for me, please. Rule of action. A rule of action. It is the rule by which action must follow and conform to. There is moral law and there is physical law. Physical law is that rule of action imposed upon everything that is physical. It is that rule of action that is the law of necessity. Physical law is the law of necessity. Anybody know what I mean by the law of necessity? Another term for it. Law of cause and effect. Every time there's a cause, there will be an effect. Every time. Every time there's a cause, there's an effect. Every time. That is a law. That is a rule. That action always happens. When there's the right cause, it always produces the same effect. And our whole lives depend on this law always being enforced by the Creator, our God. If that was not absolutely dependable, how many of you would get on a plane if it was possible that the laws of aerodynamics would not work that day? Not me, unless I was willing to die that day. We absolutely, and this is the beauty of God's creation and His physical laws, that they are so absolutely dependable, we can enjoy the great good that we do in this world because we can depend upon His laws working the same way all the time. They're absolute, and He upholds the physical law by His power and keeps all of His physical laws operating. Moral law is the rule of action for moral beings. It is the law of liberty. It is not the law of cause and effect. It is not the law of necessity. It is the law of liberty. It is the law of choice. It is not the law of force. It is the law of liberty and choice. Anybody here have a free will? Anybody here does not have a free will? Everyone who has a free will is a free moral agent, provided they have also intellect and sensibilities. The law, moral law addresses and is a rule of action for moral agents. It is a requirement that moral agents, not physical objects, live and act a certain way. The rule of action for, in particular, the will. The moral law says and addresses the will and requires the will to be directed at a certain object. But it is moral law because it's the law of liberty, and that means that the will is capable of not obeying, because nothing is causing the will to have to obey. It is free to refuse to obey that rule of action. It has that liberty. So it is moral law because the possibility of disobeying it is there because of the will. Under God's moral law that He enforces and upholds, moral law has rewards and punishments. Under moral law, there is rewards and punishments. What do you have if you have a law without punishment? License, a good idea. License, okay. Somebody else? Suggestion. Advice. The 10 suggestions. Right? Moses went up and came down with the 10 suggestions. No, he came down with the 10 commandments. They were law to Israel, and they had punishments connected with them. Without punishments connected with them and executed, there is not moral law. There's only moral suggestions. If you do not execute the punishment, it is not law. That is how governments virtually set aside law. When they decide a law is not working to the public good, if they can't get it repealed, they simply stop executing any punishment for breaking it. and de facto it ceases to be law. That's how human governments operate those things. Without sanction, moral law has no authority. What is the purpose for moral law? What's the purpose of law? What's the purpose of the moral law? Somebody says the greater good. Anybody? To control. The purpose of the moral law is to control. Okay. Anybody else?
Consistency with the character of God.
Purpose of the law is to be consistent with the character of God. Okay. What's the purpose of the physical law? Certainty. Physical laws that God created, He created to produce the greatest possible good in conjunction with the design He had in mind. The physical laws that God created are the highest and best means necessary for the end or design that He had in creation. He could have created this world with different physical laws had He had a different design or end in view to accomplish. So all the physical laws that He brought into existence are means to accomplish a wonderful end. The moral law is also the means to produce the greatest good in the universe, to promote the highest well-being of moral agents in the universe, the whole universe, heaven and earth combined. Wherever there are moral agents, the moral law is there, and its purpose is to promote the greatest good. Adherence to the moral law would produce the greatest good in a society. So suppose we had a king, a very benevolent king, a very loving king. And this king, with his great wisdom, conceived of and announced certain laws for the good of his kingdom. And given the fact that he was a benevolent king and given the fact that he had great wisdom, his conceived ideas of law would have been directed to promoting the greatest good for all of his subjects. Okay? Given that to be a true statement, let's suppose one of his subjects says, I don't like that law. I can't pursue what I want to pursue and still obey the king's law. Now, if the laws that the king announced and commanded would in fact produce the greatest good, then that man's actions in deviating from that would detract from the greatest good in some measure. The king says, no stealing from your neighbor. And it was known that that would produce the greatest good because every neighbor would be in a better state than if people were stealing from him. One person deciding to break that command would reduce the well-being of that society by some measure. But adherence to it by everyone would give everyone the highest state of blessedness, security, well-being that could possibly be conceived. So that's the purpose of law. But where does moral law come from? This is a very important point. Where does moral law come from? What is its origin? Anybody? What's the origin of the moral law?
The nature of our being.
Someone says it's the nature of our being. It's inherent. I understand what he's saying by that. It doesn't quite answer the question I'm asking in the way I'm asking it, at least. What is the origin of the moral law? Somebody says it's the Spirit of God. Would you like to say what you mean by that? Spirit of God is the origin of the moral law? What's in your...
Body, soul, and spirit. God threw the Spirit into us. That's part of us. concurrent with.
Okay.
That part of us is like God.
Okay. Made in the image of God, saying something very okay. Did the breathing of the Spirit of God into Adam create the moral law? It's the moral law is as eternal as God is, and for the same reason.
The first principle. It's the law of His being. Yes.
It's the law of His being. The moral law is the law of His being. Somebody is saying. The moral law is as eternal as God is, and for the same reason. What do some people believe is the origin of the moral law? Excuse me?
God himself.
God himself.
The will of God.
The will of God.
But it's a capricious, in other words, it's arbitrary. It's what he decided he was going to make. That's what they...
Okay, the idea is that the will of God creates the law of God. By the fact that God commands something, it makes it law. The question that underlies that, or comes out of that, is, does God command something because it's right, or is it right because God commands it? Ever puzzled that one? Ever thought of it? Is the law of God right because God commands it, or does God command it because it's right? And the difficulty with that is, if somebody says God commands it because it's right, suggests that there's something greater than God. Something came before God. Something that God has to bow down to, which would make that God. And that's the difficulty that's suggested to the mind, to say that God commands that which is right. So the alternative is, it's right because God commands it. God creates the moral law by commanding it. And that it did not exist until He commanded it. But that produces a government of arbitrary will. That produces a government of tyranny. If God's will did not create the moral law, what in the world did create moral law? Well, nothing did create moral law. Nothing created moral law. Moral law, which we will define pretty soon, is coexistent with God. It didn't come before God and did not come into existence after God. But it is coexistence with God. The moral law is an idea in God's reason, an idea in the mind of God, a mind capable of knowing all things that can be known, a mind capable of infinite wisdom to select the greatest means or the greatest end that His reason could conceive of, and His reason could conceive of all possible highest goods that could be accomplished. His reason, His what we would call intellect, is capable of perceiving, is it not, the highest possible rule of living that would produce the highest possible good in any world? That is the origin of the moral law. The infinite wisdom of God perceiving out of all possible rules of action the rule of action that would produce the highest good in all worlds where there are moral beings. And since He is benevolent, He is forever committed to conform Himself to that same idea, that same rule of action, so that the greatest good in the universe would come about. Now, I know this is a little philosophical, but you can all handle it. God, the infinite, eternal, benevolent God, knowing the rule of action that all moral beings ought to follow in order to produce the greatest good, and since He is, in fact, benevolent, He has committed Himself to promote the greatest good by following that rule of action himself. And so the moral law is the law of a rule of action by which God himself conforms himself to. He follows no other rule of action. That's marvelous. It's marvelous that God follows no other rule of action except those things that would produce the highest good, the greatest well-being for all moral beings. When my mind saw that, when my mind saw that fact, understood it by various proofs and various arguments laid out and descriptions of it, when my mind saw that, I had reasons to believe everything he does in the administration of his government is intended to produce good. Not to destroy people, not to be vindictive against people, not to harm people, but he is after the greatest good, which might require that he punish people. In order to uphold law, to keep it law, he would have to execute punishment. But that is only a necessary means to uphold law, government, and bring about the greatest good. So the origin of the moral law is right out of the nature of God, not the will of God. What do I mean by his nature? What I mean by his nature is his mind, his intellect, the perception of what would be the greatest rule of action for moral beings to produce the greatest good, that nature that he has, that is capable of seeing these things and thinking these things and viewing these things and knowing these things, that's the origin of the moral law. And then he himself has committed himself to adhere to that rule of action because it would produce the greatest good. And that you can depend on forever, that God is committed to that. Why? Because he declares, I am God that changeth not. He also declares, the Bible declares, God is love. If he is love today and he changes not, he will forever be conformed to the moral law. You'll see the connection of love and the moral law in just a moment. But if God is love, which is conformity to the moral law, you'll see that, and if he changes not, then you can be absolutely certain that throughout eternity, either direction, everything that he has done is a means to producing the greatest good. That's why when we declare God is righteous, what's the measure? The moral law. That's the measure of righteousness. Now I'm getting into the character of God, and I've got to keep from going into the third session or on the first session. And my mind has that difficulty of keeping these separate, because they're wonderful truths that flow together. Under moral law, moral agents can be praiseworthy for adhering to the moral law, or they're blameworthy for disobeying the moral law. They either are virtuous because they're in total conformity to the moral law, or they are vicious or full of vice or full of evil and wicked because they have broken God's moral law. It is an administration over the law that gives rewards and punishments. People have a guilty conscience for living under the law and breaking it. People have peace when they're in total conformity to the law of God and the moral law. Conscience is man's faculty that God has put in there to affirm the moral law to the person, to affirm that this is an obligation, to affirm that one ought to live by this rule of action, and if one does not, they are blameworthy. That comes from your conscience. That doesn't come from the devil. When a person feels condemned, it's probably because they are. When a person becomes convicted, that's the work of the Holy Spirit. When a person becomes convicted that they're condemned, that's the work of the Holy Spirit affirming the rightness of the moral law through the conscience. That's not the work of the devil. The devil would not be interested in trying to see that you're condemned under the law, because that might waken you up to get converted. The devil's not interested in that. The devil's interested in keeping people thinking that they have no need of Jesus and a Savior. not waking them up to a sense of condemnation. Condemnation is the work of the conscience affirming the moral law has been broken and the person is guilty. Just as Paul says in Romans chapter 2, on that great day of judgment, the consciences of all men, Gentiles and Jews, will stand before God. He's speaking particularly about Gentiles who have not heard the law through Moses. That before God, their own conscience will affirm or disaffirm, approve or disapprove of the light that they've had and whether or not they've conformed to it. Whether or not the moral law revealed through creation and in their own conscience, they have followed or not followed. And before judgment, they will condemn themselves and then God will follow through on what they deserve. What a terrible thing to live in this world with a conscience that is constantly judging you and pronouncing guilt. And it's because a person is guilty. That's why. It's pronouncing guilt. They're guilty. Breaking the moral law. What does the moral law command? We've looked at some of the characteristics of moral law, and there are others. But what does this rule of action that is intended to produce the highest good in the universe, what does it command? We've looked at law, we've looked at some things of moral law, but what does the moral law command?
Perfect conformity.
Commands perfect conformity, somebody says. Anybody else? Law is always in the form of commands, not requests or pleas. The commands, thou shalt. If you're raising children, if you command them, you say, you will. You don't say, please do. That's not a command. You might think it's a command in a very kind way so that they will go with it, but understand that if you say, will you please do this? Okay, please. You're asking for them to agree with your reasons not to obey your commands. God does not ask us to agree with His reasons. He asks us to follow His commands. The commands of the moral law. What does the moral law command? Does the moral law command perfect conformity? Is that the word you use?
Do that which would most please God.
Do that. Is that you, John? No. Tim? Do that which would most please God. What would most please God? Thank you. What's your name, please?
Jeff.
Love God with all our heart, mind, soul, strength, and love our neighbor. Is that not the law? Is that not the law? We talk about the law of Moses. We've got the Ten Commandments. Then we've got the ceremonies and the worships. But the ceremonies and the sacrifices are things commanded to Moses for Israel to do if they broke the Ten Commandments. To be reconciled to God if they broke the Ten Commandments. But the Ten Commandments are the law, the commands. The ceremonies are the provisions if the commands are broken. Now Jesus asked, when asked what is the greatest of these ten, trying to destroy his ministry and his influence, said, which is the greatest? And of course Jesus said, all of them can be combined into these two things. Love God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. And Paul comes along and says, I think in the 15th chapter of Romans, owe no man anything but to love him, because love fulfills the law. Love is the fulfillment of the law. He's simply following what our Lord taught us regarding the law. That everything that is the commandment, the moral law of God, is wrapped up in love. Love to certain objects to certain degrees. Who is more important as far as the importance of your well-being? You or God? John? God's well-being is more important than mine, isn't it, and yours? Aren't his interests, his well-being, his state of blessedness, isn't that more important? As an infinite being who has the responsibilities of moral government in the universe, he has infinite interests. Aren't they more important than my finite interests? That is why the commandment is to love God with all your heart, because his interests deserve all of our devotion. That's the spirit of the law. To give to the most important things the most important devotion, and give to the less important things less important devotion, less degree of devotion. That's the spirit of the law. So when Jesus told us that the spirit of the law is wrapped up in thou shalt love God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, another word that I like to use and is used is thou shalt love God supremely. He shall be the object of your life, love above all other objects and all other interests. You're to love him with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. That's what the moral law commands. It wouldn't command perfect conformity. It would command that we love God with all of our heart, mind, soul, and strength. It wouldn't command that we please him. It commands that we love him with all of our heart, mind, soul, and strength. It doesn't command that we desire to love him with all of our heart, mind, soul, and strength. It commands that we do love him with all of our heart, mind, soul, and strength. If a person says, I really want to love God with all my heart, mind, soul, and strength, they've not yet come into conformity or obeying the moral law, because they don't. They just want to. And this is a great trap that people live in thinking that this strong desire to follow the Lord and obey him constitutes the obedience that they want. But it is a fact certain that anytime you want something, you don't have it. Is that not true? If you had it, you wouldn't want it, because you have it. But the law requires loving him supremely, loving him with all of our heart, and if a person wants to do that, that is not yet the obedience required. It is just the wanting to obey. You know, when probably most of you are married in here, you got married and your spouse on that day, that wonderful day, said, will you take this man, will you take this woman, make these vows? And the spouse looks to you and says, I really want to. I want to so much. That's all I want. Above everything else that I want, that's what I want to do, is to be faithful to you and love you and live with you and seek your good. Is that good enough? Would you accept that? Maybe some of you had accepted that. Maybe that's what you pledged. I pledged to you that I want to love you and be faithful to you all of our days. That's not a pledge. Because wanting something and having it is not the same. Suppose your spouse said to you, or the one that was going to be your spouse, oh, thank you for asking me, or thank you for accepting my offer, and I want you to know I really, really want to be faithful to you as a spouse. That is my strongest desire, is to be faithful to you, love you. However, I've got this nature. That just can't refuse the approaches of the opposite sex. And I want you to understand that I really want to love you and be faithful. But I've got this nature that just can't refuse. You going to go ahead and get married? You say to that person saying to you, I really want to love you and be faithful to you. And you look at them and say, then why don't you? Because you know they can. You know, they have the ability to be faithful. And you know, you have the ability to be faithful. But it requires commitment, not desire. It's wonderful when a person can say to their spouse, honey, I am faithful to you. It's not so very comforting when a person says, I want to be faithful to you, honey. Kind of a shadow there, isn't there? Huh? Kind of a... Something missing? Just I wanted to see revival. I wanted to love God. I wanted to be walking in His truth. I wanted God. And I considered my wants proof that I knew Him. I didn't know Him. I only wanted Him. I never yet had found Him. So the moral law commands that God's interests, which are infinite, be given their proper treatment, infinite loyalty and infinite love and infinite regard. That's what love is, which we'll see. The law commands love. Love or devotion to the interests according to their real importance or level of value. God's interests are infinite. We should give them infinite regard, which means we would give our interests a finite regard. Which means when His interests are known to us and required of us and require our denials and service and love and giving and going, we're willing to do that if we're committed to loving. If somebody is living according to this rule of action, when God's interests are known, which are infinite in value, known to us that they require this or that of us, it's an automatic commitment. The commitment's been made prior. Somebody to become a disciple comes and lays down his life, takes up his cross and follows Him. You don't do that every day. It is a commitment here, which thereafter affects everything that you do. And that's what love requires. His interest above every interest, because they are in fact more important and supremely more important, so we're to treat them, give them the proper regard. That is why there's such injustice in disobedience to the moral law. Because when you give every interest its proper regard, that is the just thing to do. But when you give your own interests supreme regard, that is unjust, because they don't deserve that much interest in that regard. So the moral law is simply, in one respect, a very just law, because it is simply giving interests their proper regard and proper value. And then I am to love you as I love myself. That means I am to consider your interests and my interests of equal value. I am to consider your well-being and happiness of equal value to my own. I am to so consider you and treat you that if I were to exchange places with you and receive the treatment I am giving you, I wouldn't feel like I lost a thing. See that? In my treatment of you, in my regard for you, in my intent to do you good and give you, to love you as I love myself, would mean if I traded places with you, I wouldn't feel like I was being cheated out of what was due me. Now then, if that's what the law requires and commands, then what is disobedience to the law? What would be some names we would put on disobedience to the law? Selfishness, okay?
Partiality.
Pardon me?
Partiality.
Partiality. Selfishness.
Betrayal.
Betrayal. A lot of names, a lot of words could come into play, couldn't it? Why is it selfishness? That is the operative word. The opposite of love is not hate. It is selfishness. A lot of selfish people cannot say, I hate you. And they don't hate you. They just love themselves more than they should. Selfishness. When a person is committed to an interest that is not worth the regard that they give it, when a person makes their own interests supreme and commits themselves to pursuing their own interests as the end for which they live, that is in direct conflict with the law of God, which requires that I put the infinite interests above everything else. We call that also sin. Some people think selfishness is a sin, a form of sin. Selfishness is the sum total of sin. It is the core of sin. It is the essence of sin. Sin is the transgression of the law. The law requires this giving regard, proper regard to proper interests. And when a person does not, as a transgression of that law, a violation of that law, that's when it is sin. You know the scriptures, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God? You know the picture? For all have sinned, missed the mark? And the idea is, well, everybody has pulled their bow out and their arrow and shot at doing what God requires and what the law says, but they come short. They just don't have the ability, the energy to make that arrow go far enough and hit the target. So therefore, all have missed the mark. And that's not the true picture. The reason they missed the mark is because they're not aiming at the right target. They're aiming at self-interest above everything. So they missed the mark. No lack of ability to hit the mark, but you've got to aim at it. You've got to aim and have your heart devoted entirely in its ultimate intent to love God supremely and give Him all of His interests their proper regard, and love your neighbor with the proper regard as if he were yourself. That can be aimed at and that can be hit. But to miss the mark is because people aim at their self-interest supremely. This has nothing to do with feelings or desires. This has to do with what people commit themselves to. This is the will involved. That's why it's moral actions and it's a violation of the moral law. Because remember, the moral law addresses the will. The moral law says this is the rule of action for the will. This is where the will is to direct itself as a rule. When a person directs their will to an object that is not according to the law of God, it's sin. Not following that rule of action that is commanded. Who is subject to the moral law?
All moral beings.
All moral beings are subject to the moral law. What does it take to be a moral being? If all moral beings are subject to this moral law and required to follow it and conform to it, that is, all moral beings are required to love God supremely and love their neighbor as if he was himself, who, definitively, what is a moral agent, a moral being? What does he have to have? What are the components that go together to make him a moral being? We have intellect, first of all. Second is free will, which is a redundancy in terms, but we use it, don't we? Because to say a person has a will means that it's free. But free will is a good term. Anything else? Let me start over here. John?
Volition
would come under free will. It's an act of will. Volition is a form of will, action. Jim, excuse me?
A conscience.
Conscience, okay. Ron, would you come up here, please? Two different kinds here. Would you pass one to each one, please? I'll give you this to pass out. We're not going to spend a lot of time on it, but it's for your future reference to look at this. And in our discussion, I will briefly go through it. But you can go back and consider it, because this is an anthropology that you need to understand. The church has failed greatly in its anthropology. Great important things depend upon one's view of how man is made, is it not? Your view of how you are made determines your view of sin, and that determines what you need to be saved from, and that determines what kind of salvation God would have to provide in order to be saved from the sin, based upon how you think sin is, based upon how you think you are made. They're directly connected. Directly connected. You've got some drawings there. You've got one for me, Ron. Please bring it up. Thank you. That scenario? When we, whatever we conceive of as our natures, our makeup, our being, and how we're put together, will determine our view of what sin is. And that will determine the kind of salvation our minds would need to find in order to be saved, to satisfy our minds that we are saved. And that would determine our view of God's salvation, because His salvation, if it does not address our view of our sin, would be inadequate to save us, in our view, in our understanding of it. So if we view sin as being of this nature, it's because we viewed ourselves as being this way. And they're directly connected. Thank you, Ron. This is you, the mind of the moral agent or man. In our minds, I have three sections. The will, intellect, and it's called the sensibilities. The will is free will, it's self-defined. The ability to choose between objects of choice freely, without force, without being forced to. Not as an effect, it is causative of action itself. Intellect consists of the reason, the conscience, and self-consciousness. The only reason that you know you're here today is because you have this faculty called self-consciousness. If you didn't have that faculty, you wouldn't know that you were here. You wouldn't know that I was here. I demonstrate this as the faculty or power of self-consciousness is the mind in the act of knowing itself, as Finney would describe it. I use the illustration of a camcorder. We all know what camcorders are. Camcorders is this thing that sits on your shoulder and views and records everything that's going on. God put in us a camcorder that sits in the back of, up above, if you will. It's on the top row of the bleachers of the football field. And it observes it observes everything that's going on the field of play. And that is how we know that things are going on in the field of play, because this camera is making us aware of it. Self-consciousness is the power whereby we can view our mental actions and states. It makes us aware of them. We are aware that we think. We are aware of the workings of our conscience. We are aware of choices made. We are aware of sensibilities through this power of self-consciousness. Conscience is that faculty or power put in the mind by God that says, recognizes and affirms moral obligation, moral law when it hears it, affirms obligation to conform to that law, and pronounces judgment whether that law has been conformed to or disobeyed. The reason in the intellect is that power to think of ideas, to contemplate ideas, to develop thoughts, the thinking process. This is where truth is perceived. This is the only place where truth is perceived. Not here, not the will. The will doesn't think. The will only chooses between objects of choice. That's all it does. The reason conceives of ideas. Ideas I've been saying to you this morning, if you've conceived of them, if you've realized them, if you've viewed them, if you've contemplated them, if you're thinking on them, this is the reason working on you. The fact that you know you're thinking is your self-consciousness observing your self-thinking. And these are just self-evident things that we don't think about much, because we just know that they're going on. Until we get into theology, and then we lose our sense, lose our common sense. Then there's this other section in the mind called the sensibilities. And they consist of the desires, passions, emotions, sensations, pain, pleasure, feelings, sensibilities. That's the flesh. Ephesians chapter 2 describes those who are dead in their trespasses and sins as those who lived according to the desires of the mind and of the flesh. Two things. We have desires of the mind, the desire to know knowledge. We just have the desires of the flesh to feel certain things, to gratify. You can just as much gratify the desire for knowledge as you can gratify the desire for physical pleasure. They're both gratifications. We have limited sin mostly to this physical area and the sensibilities area. Now, the sensibilities are not all physical by the sense that